master bond. There is no leaving us now. You tied to the chair with those headphones will make you listen to this program, and you will die a horrible death.
Yes, but I see you've put my favorite program on, Media Network Plus, so ha 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 to you.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perrell.
All right, with a little bit of silliness out of the way, hello and welcome to the program. Now, usually when we talk to Jeff White, I say we're now going to go to Miami, Florida. Well, this time, we're not going to do that because he's at the other side of the world. In fact, a little bit maybe under the globe. He's all the way in Auckland, New Zealand. Now, the reason why he's joining us, because he just attended the HFCC, which took place in Brisbane, Australia. He's been doing a little bit of a detour before he heads back home. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Keith.
Now, you are in Auckland, New Zealand right now, but you were actually just in Australia for the HFCC, which took place in Brisbane. With some of the changes that have been happening, what was this year's HFCC like?
Well, it was a little bit smaller than usual, Keith. We have usually around 100 people taking part, and we had only about 75 or so this time. But that was really kind of what we expected, because a lot of the HFCC members live in Europe or the Middle East, and it's a long ways for them. It's a long way to travel and a lot of money for a lot of the countries that participate in this. So we knew that the participation would be somewhat reduced this time, but for 75, I think we were doing pretty well. For Australia. And the thing is, the members in Australia and here in the Pacific area in general have to travel a long way every time to the HFCC, twice a year. So it's only fair that once in 25 years, for the first time, I think that we have an HFCC in Australia.
So I take it then there were a lot of Asian countries and Pacific nations that attended this time that maybe previously hadn't attended before.
I'm not sure if there were any new ones who haven't attended before, but there were, certainly, yes, a lot of, Asian and Pacific countries, more than usual, attending. And that was very good. Now a lot of times the, Asian and Pacific countries attend the, A meeting, which is the one in, January or February. But a lot of them attended this one also, which is a B meeting, but in more in their neck of the woods, so to speak.
Now, just out of curiosity, I mean, now since the voice of Russia doesn't exist, and now it's Sputnik, and now they're no longer on shortwave, were there any Russians there?
There was one person from the General Radio Frequency Center. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I they may be planning something, or they may be they're on standby. I don't know, in case something reappears or some funding reappears or something. But there was one Russian at this meeting.
Now, just a moment ago, I said that you were in Brisbane. Now, a lot of people would think, well, wait a second, Radio Australia is in Melbourne, which is the other side of the country. Wasn't this hosted by Radio Australia?
No, actually, it was hosted by Reach Beyond Australia, and this is the former HCJB Australia. And Reach Beyond, in fact, has its headquarters... its Australian headquarters in Melbourne as well, but their frequency coordinator, Ken Lingwood, lives in Brisbane, and he was the primary organizer of this event, so it was held in Brisbane. That's the sole reason.
Oh, okay. were there any people there from Radio Australia?
Yes, there was. Gary Baxter from Radio Australia was there. doing frequencies, and also Broadcast Australia, which is the organization that actually owns or manages the transmitter sites for Radio Australia and the ABC, was there.
Now, you also attended a 50th anniversary party, and it wasn't for Radio Australia, was it?
Actually, Keith, it was the 50th anniversary, but not of Radio Australia. It was the Australian Radio DX Club, and they were celebrating their 50 years just the week after the HSCC, and just a few days after, actually. And I had an opportunity to go down to Sydney, where their headquarters is, and attend their 50th anniversary annual general meeting. And it was a very nice event, about 30 people there from all over Australia. And we had a little get-together there in Sydney.
Now, of course, you were there for a very short time, but what is DXing like in Australia?
I wish I could tell you from experience, but in Brisbane, we were the headquarters of the hotel where we were at was in downtown Brisbane, so it was just a horrible location for doing any shortwave listening. I took out my radio a few times, but couldn't hear much except noise. And then in Sydney, I was also in a hotel in downtown, really bad place for doing DXing. But when we were in Brisbane the day before, 2 days before the HFCC began, I had a chance to attend a barbecue put on by the local branch of the Australian Radio DX Club. And a guy named John Smith, or Smithy, hosted the event at his house. And this guy has, I would bet, at least 100 shortwave receivers. And they are all in a big block, in a big closet in his house. And they take up a whole room, really. And they're all connected to the electricity and all to antennas, and you can DX anything you want on these radios there. And he has a very good setup out in the suburbs of Brisbane. And I didn't hear it while I was at his house, but the next day he sent me a recording that he made of WRMI at 11580 kilohertz at 8 o'clock in the morning his time. Beautiful reception. If you're in the right location, DXing it can be good. Also, here in Auckland, where I am now, I'm down in downtown Auckland, not a good place for DXing. But Brian Clark from the New Zealand Radio DX League, I was told, lives about 110 kilometers north of here, in a very nice location, and is able to pick up all kinds of stuff. Arthur Cushion, I learned, the famous Arthur Cushion, lived in Invercargill, which is the southern tip of the South Island, nothing between him and Antarctica, and was able to pick up all kinds of stuff, as you know.
Yeah, it's interesting, because a few years ago when I was in Papua New Guinea, I remember turning on a shortwave radio and hearing stations that here, normally I can't hear in Taiwan, because Papua New Guinea is surrounded by water. There was very little electrical noise, and stations, let's say, that would be very difficult to hear here were better to come there, because there was just no interference from anywhere.
Well, I'm hoping to actually do a little listening, because tomorrow I'm going off to the Cook Islands for 3 days. And they're going to be right on the beach, and a very good location for listening, I think.
Well, actually, what I'll do is I'll send you the PCJ frequencies and times for the Pacific, because you'll be able to pick us up in the Cook Islands, that's for sure.
Absolutely, we'll try.
Now, when is the next HFCC taking place?
It's going to be the last week in January in Istanbul, Turkey.
Oh.
Co-hosted by the TRT, Turkish Radio Television, and we're looking forward to that, although it's going to be a little bit cooler, I think.
Jeff White, thank you very much for talking to us today, and sorry to wake you up at that very ungodly hour.
No problem, Keith. Talk to you anytime.
We now head to the Kingdom of Bhutan. Now, there's a secret in Bhutan, which is if you want to keep a secret, write it down in a book. That's because the culture is a very much an oral one rather than a written one. Now, there, of course, is government and state media. But since it is an oral culture instead of a written one, what is it like to start a newspaper? That's the question that Richard Ady put to Bute Iverson. He's a journalist and writer, lecturer of journalism at the University of Sydney.
The time that they decided to launch newspapers was around the same time that newspapers were being so challenged everywhere else in the world. So it was a big call for a couple of reasons, and it's had mixed success.
Well, that's it. You said there was one newspaper run by the government. Nobody read it. So there's yes. No culture of reading newspapers.
No, there's no culture of reading. It's an oral culture.
No culture of reading at all.
No culture of reading at all. That's changing slowly, but culturally, no. It's an oral culture where they had, there's something like 23 different languages, not dialects, but languages, and all of them are oral with no written form. And then the king decided about 30 years ago that they needed to be able to create a written form for one of these languages as part of this moving into the modern world. So while there was, the monasteries had prayer books and they had writing and reading, the mainstream people didn't write things down and they didn't read.
So in fact, isn't there a saying that if you want to keep a secret in Bhutan, write it in a book?
That's right, because no one will read it.
Okay, I can see what possessed you then.
It was a challenge, unlike any other.
Well, let's get a sense of the paper itself, so the office and the staff. Given that there's no real tradition of reading newspapers, how much training did the people who were actually putting the paper out have?
Well, they didn't have any training. Well, it varied. Some of them had gone to India and had worked on newspapers there or been trained. The newspaper that existed, the government one, had evolved over time. And the story of the government newspaper was quite an interesting one. The man who launched it, Kinley Dorji, came to Australia to learn to be a journalist. And he was the country's first journalist. And that was about 25, 30 years ago. And he was in the same year as Andrew Denton and Amanda Keller
right.
at Bathurst. And he was sent by the king at the time to go and learn to be a journalist, come back and start or move our government gazette towards being a newspaper. So that government gazette, Kunsul newspaper, was started by the country's first journalist that was trained in Australia. And then he trained people under him that worked on that newspaper. So there was, when I say that there was no tradition of newspapers, not amongst the mainstream, certainly the educated government people and the royal family read the newspaper, but the majority of people didn't. And so when the family that I knew decided they wanted to start a newspaper, there weren't any journalists to kind of, you know, poach or to, and they couldn't bring people in from outside.
How did they recruit?
Well, the recruiting was a lot of fun. They invited university graduates to come and explain what they would do on the newspaper. And the ones that wrote an essay in English that made the most sense about what a newspaper could be got the job. The sense of enthusiasm, and this is a brave new world, was brilliant.
And I suppose the other thing is that you don't know what you can't do. You're not restricted by the kind of the norms of doing a newspaper or the orthodoxies of how you do journalism.
That's right. Absolutely.
And that can be positive.
And they came up with such creative ways to do things. For example, there was no businesses to go and say, buy space to sell your product. They just didn't have that kind of marketing advertising culture. So what they did is they went to Wikipedia and downloaded a list of days. You know, like there's International Tuberculosis Day, International Hand Washing Day, International Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Yes.
They downloaded that list, highlighted all the ones that they thought were relevant, and then went to various NGOs and government departments to get them to sponsor information pullouts that week. So it wasn't advertising as we would recognise it. It was more public service pullouts that matched these international days.
All right. So how did it fit into this newly evolving media landscape? Because you've already mentioned there was the government paper. And I think there was another independent starting around the same time.
Yes, two of them launched at the same time, Bhutan Times and Bhutan Observer. They were greeted with a lot of enthusiasm, and it appeared to a lot of the educated class that this was a good thing to do to launch newspapers. There are currently, or last time I looked, there was a dozen newspapers. All of them are failing. There still isn't advertising. There still isn't much of a newspaper culture.
What is in them? If I pick up one of these papers, if I pick up the paper you worked at, what am I going to read about, assuming I can read that language?
You'll read very much what's going on with the Bhutanese government, with what's happening in the main city of Thimphu. It's very local news, and it's things about the roads, what the farmers are doing, the price of potatoes. Very domestic news.
It's a very agricultural country, isn't it?
So yes.
You're going to, I imagine, there's going to be a lot about agriculture.
Yes. And there's also a lot about the royal family.
I guess the royal family's at the top of the hierarchy. Is there a tradition in which you can ask hard questions of people who are kind of not at your level?
It's a very hierarchical structure socially. So that has been a challenge for them with this new media landscape, or now having journalists asking questions, because traditionally you wouldn't. Traditionally you wouldn't ask questions of a very important person or somebody who was part of the senior government or certainly the royals. You just wouldn't question them. But that's been turned on its head now that they are a democracy and now that there is an active media.
And so how do the people who are not used to being asked questions, who've spent perhaps decades not being asked questions, when somebody rolls up and asks them a question?
It's been very challenging. So some of the government ministers have refused to respond, but they're in a state of everybody's learning their roles. So the journalists are learning to ask the hard questions and the ministers are learning to be accountable. And it's a bit of a dance and it's a bit of learning on both sides and in constant negotiation.
I can't ask about Bhutan without thinking of this gross national happiness, because that is probably the thing that Bhutan's best known for, isn't it?
Yes.
Is it real?
Yeah. Look, I spent a lot of time trying to get my head around gross national happiness. This is something that comes up in conversation pretty much every part of the day.
Really?
It is so much part of their public discussion about, yes.
So at news meetings, when you're trying to work out what you're covering, it's going to come up?
Yes, repeatedly. It is how they frame all of the what they consider to be progress within their country.
You tell a story, actually, in your book about a reporter who actually, you're trailing along these sorts of public meetings where everyone says how full of gross national happiness they are, he actually tests that and finds it's not that simple.
Yes. He went along because they once a year they will go right across the country and interview every single inhabitant to ask them about their level of happiness and how they're going.
And people say they're fantastically happy, don't they?
People are confronted with these important people from the capital, Thimphu. They're visiting them. They're so overwhelmed and impressed that these people have come, and they say yes to anything that they're asked. And this reporter from the Bhutan Observer saw this going on, and because he was also from a poor village, he could see exactly what was going on. So after these important men with their ledgers left, he asked the local farmers, and are you happy? And they said, well, of course not. We haven't got enough food to eat. And he was able to unpack, using his skills as a journalist and using his voice as a journalist and his platform, he was able to bring that to the fore in a way that their institutionalised structures weren't.
No, indeed. How did the story go down, though?
Beautifully. It's what they wanted. It's part of this kind of change and dynamism even the Gross National Happiness Commission themselves, who were conducting the survey, were happy that it came out. That's what they're trying to, you know, dismantle and discover.
You mentioned earlier that there's now something like 12 newspapers and they're all sort of struggling.
Yes.
What about, and also that the country is very, it's a spoken culture. Where does that leave social media, something like Facebook?
Yes. Well, this is what has been such an extraordinary change for them. So while newspapers arrived and were struggling, at the same time digital media arrived, mobile phones were phenomenally successful. There's something like 93% of households have a mobile phone.
Wow.
And they use them to do all sorts of things. They use them to stream radio. So you've got yak farmers in, you know, in remote mountain areas who are completely up to date with what's happening in politics and streaming Parliament live on their mobile phones. They're a terribly politically engaged culture. But then they're also using Facebook. Facebook has been phenomenal. It's created this space where they now have all that public discussion that the King wanted to happen in the newspapers, but it just being an oral culture in the newspapers weren't so successful. Modern media, digital media, has created this space for all of that. So the Facebook pages are, they use them for political activism, for culture. They use it like a virtual town square. Facebook has been, somehow it has absolutely culturally been appropriate for them. They love it.
So this change that the King instigated, it's working. And what it's doing, though, is exposing problems of if you don't have enough to eat, if you, and, you know, there's a lot of poverty in a country like Bhutan. It's not the Shangri-La that we, it's too often easy to think of, a country which celebrates and, you know, gross national happiness. These changes, beginning with newspapers, but also with mobiles and social media, they're actually making a difference.
Yes. What I found so interesting going back there again and again is that before newspapers arrived, before television arrived, in particular television, there was a lot of talk in the West and concern that it would ruin Bhutan, all this outside influence. But actually what the Bhutanese are doing with all these modern media is they're using it to talk amongst themselves, and they're using it to reflect their own culture to each other. And before mobile phones and things, if you're talking about remote farmers, they would see other farmers once a year at the annual Seshu, the festival. Now they have a media space where they find about history, about their leaders, about their culture. So it's created a really vibrant space where they're talking and they're animated and they're criticising and showcasing all things that are important to them.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Corey 105, reduce speed to 22 knots.
Speed 220, Corey 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
And you are listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Well, it's now time to turn our attention to propagation and what's been happening and what we can expect. Here is our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2 on September 7th to 11th, 17th, 21st to 23rd. Solar flux lowest at 85 through September 10th, then rising to a peak of 115 September 13th to 22nd, and down to 90 by September 26th. Bill Hepburn's VHF-UHF maps call for very strong tropospheric ducting September 6th over Minnesota, moving across the Great Lakes September 7th and 8th. Extreme ducting around Crete, Cyprus, and Egypt most of the week. Also moving from the western to eastern Black Sea and all around the Arabian Peninsula.
All right, thanks a lot, Glenn. Now, just a quick program note. On October the 3rd and October the 10th, we will be away. So we're going to be presenting two special editions of Media Network Plus on those 2 days. There won't be any propagation on those two editions of the program, but it will be returning to normal on October the 17th. Anyway, if you'd like to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. Once again, mnp@pcjmedia.com. Also look for the Media Network Plus Facebook page. It's very easy to do. Just look for Media Network Plus. And a special thank you to a number of people, actually, who post a number of media-related items on that page and take part in some of the conversations that we have. And you never know, if you put something up there, we may just use it on the program. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. Hope you have a great weekend. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. 73 and 88 to the ladies.
Thank you.